This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about policing as a factor in mental health. And this is actually an intro I'm recording for the second time a few days later. And that is because this conversation did bring up a lot for me in terms of not knowing exactly where my perspective falls on this topic, which is something that is a bit more unusual for me. I guess I'm very open to changing my perspective, but I generally, partly with this show, have to know what my perspective is on a certain amount of things. And so it can be easier for me to list off, you know, criticisms with policing than it can be to talk about the hope and the good that I can see when policing is done well, as something that's embedded in communities to keep people safe and to be that one number that you can call 24/7 and expect a far more immediate response. But then even that is so compromised at the moment with so much of policing needs to change. So many of those criticisms that I would have, and also with how, you know, the resources can so often not be there or are there for things in a way that would be different to the priorities of the people you're looking to serve. And so in today's conversation, we'll get into a lot of this nuance with a guest that is incredibly articulate on this topic. Gamal Turawa, who generally is known as G, is an educator, is a speaker on a whole range of topics relating to inclusion and mental health and so many important intersections that we talk about here on the show, but also did serve as a member of London's Metropolitan Police Service and along the way became the UK's first openly gay black police officer. And so hopefully that's a good bit of scene setting. I know I've kind of just only scratched the surface there. And like I said, there are a lot of mixed feelings for me. You know, that's me being really honest. And I hate even using that phrase. I was trying to think of a different one because mixed feelings might be taken that I agree with certain things that I don't. You know, there are so many things I would like to see change. But also there are good people in policing and there are people that are trying to save lives and look after the public. And I guess today is one of those people. And yet is also one of those people that left the force, that could no longer reconcile the way things were. And that makes me very sad. But I'm also so glad he left. I'm relieved for him. And I guess that's what I mean by mixed feelings. That for things to change, you need really brilliant officers that are there for all the right reasons. But I also would never judge any of them for leaving with the way so many forces around the world are currently. There. Maybe that's my compressed perspective. And with that said, before I go on another tangent, we'll get into this interview with G in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Gamal Turawa. I like to be called G. It's almost become my brand. G has become my brand. I now work as a freelance facilitator and diversity and inclusion trainer, stroke commentator. I came from a background that was not stable. And I think the thing that sort of like links everything in my story was trying to find that place where you belong. And I think that that's, as I've got older, I've recognized that that's been a major driver in a lot of my behaviors. Mm-hmm. And not finding that place has had a major impact on my mental health, yeah, earlier in my career. But it was all cumulative over time. It wasn't sort of like, I didn't see the mental health in the beginning. I didn't see that. I just got to a period where I just broke. And I think that's come from just life. the life I've had.
Yes, absolutely. And I relate to that a lot, you know, the struggle to figure out where you belong and realizing at times you can be living at a, you know, a time and a place in the world where there maybe isn't an answer to that question, that you have to forge your own way, and how tough that can be, particularly if you're then trying to balance mental health struggles. And so when you look back at those kind of early experiences, could you share a bit about what childhood was like for you, and was there any conversation or acknowledgement of mental ill health?
Mental health wasn't something that was in my family at that stage. I came from a background where I had a very unsettled childhood, in the sense of the first 8 years of my life, I was fostered out to a white foster family in a little village in Kent, where I spent the first 8 years. The only black people I saw, for example, were on TV in programs like Tarzan or Cowboy in Africa, where they were shown as savages. The only black people you saw who were in prominent positions or good positions was on American TV programs. But, you know, when you're a kid, you don't understand the difference between America and Britain. And then, you know, you're going to school and everything. You never saw yourself represented. It, to me, it's almost like I was in a white world, but I didn't belong there. And I would try and overcompensate to try and fit in. And little things I would do, if I was given pocket money, I would give away my pocket money. I would give away my sweets. I would give away everything just, you know, because I wanted to belong. So when I talk about belonging, for me, the impact of belonging is, it can go one of two ways. It can drive you to be better, or it can make you sacrifice parts of yourself because you want to fit in.
Yes, absolutely. And I think what you describe there is, without the context of your culture, you didn't even have anything to base your approach on. So your approach to fitting in and trying to overcome maybe stereotypes and misconceptions and racism that people were holding was very scattergun. You were like, let me do anything. Let me give away my money. Let me try and be friends with everyone, because you didn't even have the context for what might these people assume about me. What specific things do I need to overcome here?
I was just an 8-year-old kid who was trying to fit in, trying to belong. And so I was in that environment for the first 8 years, until I was about 8 years old. Then my father came down for a visit, decided that, he told my foster mother that he was taking me to London for a couple of weeks for a holiday. But what in fact he did was kidnap me from my foster parents. And then I was taken from an all-white environment to an all-black environment, where, again, I didn't fit in. Because, you know, it was a whole different dynamic. It was a whole different culture. Everything was different. You know, when you're used to being in one space, and suddenly that space that you built your identity around suddenly doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Because everybody else around you has the same identity. You're like, okay, so where do I belong again? And it's back to that, I don't know where I belong here, or how I fit in. And when I look back, that probably gave me some childhood trauma. In fact, it's positive, it gave me a lot of childhood trauma, because my father's way of dealing with that confusion was physical abuse. So I spent a lot of time, it was like social services became part of our family. Children's homes became part of my family, part of my upbringing. Running away from home became part of my upbringing. And all this was like, I don't like here. I don't want to belong here. Nobody's listening to me. Everybody's trying to tell me what to do. And I was just this kid that was just lost.
Yeah.
Totally lost.
And feeling like you're different and the outsider in either environment, the one that you've been placed in that and became your new cultural context, versus the one that you're being told, oh, this is where you actually belong. This is your family. But you realise you don't know how to fit there either.
I don't know how to fit there either. You know, there was girls that I were told my sisters that I didn't have any connection with them. There was, you know, there's the thing about attachment theory.
Yep.
Right? And I didn't have any attachment to my parents, because I hadn't grown up with them. I'd been with my parents for about a week when I was born. And then the rest of the time I was with my foster mother. So there was never any emotional, that parental bond was never there. So I always felt like an outsider. I always felt alone. And then underneath that, you know, when you're going from coming up to puberty, feelings around my sexual orientation started to arise as well. And my family was very homophobic. In fact, London was a very homophobic, or UK was a very homophobic site. And then the racism was on top of that as well. And racism was blatant in those mm-hmm. days. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't subtle, it wasn't hidden. It was on mainstream TV and programs like Love Thy Neighbor, etc. So there was no one for me to talk to. There was no one for me to go to and say, this is what I'm feeling or this is what's going on. And even when they sent me to psychologists, I was always this, I don't know who to trust. So I kept a lot inside.
Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense because you didn't have that consistency of who you can go to, who is your parental role model. And I guess you were having a lot of other people's narratives put on you of who you should trust. A lot of adults telling you, oh, you can only trust us. And we know how dangerous that is for a child, because then they just learn, well, if everyone's saying that, I can't actually trust any of them. And instead, maybe you just try and be a different version of you for each different person, and how exhausting that is.
Yeah, very much so. And that became my strategy. I mean, when you look back, I grew up in a time where it wasn't uncommon to hear of kids who wanted to, black kids, who burnt themselves with bleach because they wanted to be white. You know, it wasn't uncommon to see black people making a parody of themselves on TV because they wanted to fit in. You had comedians like Charlie Williams and Kenny Lynch, you know, who would tell what I call reverse racism jokes mm-hmm. about themselves. Yeah. They'll say things like, don't change your channel on TV. It's not a negative. I really am this color. Yeah. And jokes like that, you know, on the TV. Or, you know, I went round to my neighbor the other day and said to them, I'm better than you. And they said, how's that? I said, forgive the language, but this is the language. I haven't got a nigger living next door to me. And these were jokes they openly told. But again, I didn't see anyone who was gay. So that side of me was like burning away inside as well. And all these things, you know, you learn, whether you learn, but it's about survival rather mm-hmm. than living.
Yeah.
It's about surviving rather than living. And then it got to a point where I got to about 16 years old. And my dad told me that he wanted me to go to Nigeria on holiday for a 2-week holiday. And I was like, okay. And I went out there, partly because I'd never been on a plane, so I was really excited to go. And then after about 3 or 4 weeks, I said to my uncle, when am I going back? And my uncle laughed and said, you're not going back. Your father doesn't want you back. You're staying here. And he took my passport off me, and I was taken to a village in the middle of nowhere where I was put into a local school. And the man who ran the school was an old schoolmate of my dad's. I was basically his servant. This was a village in the middle of nowhere. There was no electricity. Hardly anyone spoke English. You know, I mean, I remember sort of like, I want to go to the toilet, I'll pick a tree. Mm. It was that remote. And I'm this 16-year-old kid from London trying to figure out, how do I fit into this? So again, I'm in that space of, I don't belong. And I don't know what's going on. I don't know how I should behave. So you survive. You try and survive. And all this starts to put stuff in your rucksack, the rucksack that you carry with life. And your rucksack, without you realizing it, your rucksack starts to become heavier and heavier and heavier. Then I managed to escape from that village, got back to Lagos. And then suddenly realized I didn't know how Lagos worked. My map of how the world works worked in the UK, but I was in a totally different environment. And I ended up being homeless, living under a bridge in Lagos. And my days consisted of everything I had, I sold. Right? So I ended up with nothing. And my days consisted of sort of like getting up in the mornings and drifting down to the river, clean yourself up, and then going around to the bars and the restaurants and everything, begging for money or begging for food. That was the place where I thought I was going to die. There was no hope, because I couldn't see any way out of that situation. Every night, you know, there'd be about 50, 60 people sleeping under this bridge. Under that bridge, you saw people getting raped. You saw people, just fights would just break out. You know, you'd wake up next to a dead body. And it was just, you just had to survive. Occasionally the police would come down and they would just round up a load of people and you wouldn't see them again. Luckily, for some reason, I was never caught up in that. And then one day I was going into one of the bars doing my routine. It just so happened that one of my uncles was there. And he saw me, took me in, got me cleaned up. And I stayed with him for a while. And then drifted round a few places. But he was always my anchor. I always would come back to him. And then he got me a job as a trainee welder in a steel plant. While I was working in that steel plant, again, it's about trying to fit in. I was coming into my 20s then. And I'd learnt to drink heavily. And I drank, not because I enjoyed the drink, but it was a way of escaping reality. Mm-hmm. A way of sort of like not dealing with what was in front of me. And then while I was working in this steel plant, somebody came to me and said, oh, you're from London, right? And I said, yeah. And they said, we've got this lump of gold. There's some white people that work here. You know how white people think and act. If you can sell this lump of gold to them, you can keep half the money and buy yourself a ticket back to London. And I thought, ooh, okay. Duh. And I took this lump of gold, went to this English guy who was there, Richard, and he took it out of the box and scraped it, and it turned out to be a lump of lead sprayed gold. And he looked at my face and he said, you've been used. And I said, yeah. But that was the beginning of a friendship. What I didn't know at the time, he was the only English guy that was working there. You know, and I was from England as well. So we had that in common. And then his wife came over for a holiday. And at the end of their holiday, we sat down and we were talking at a barbecue. We had a little barbecue. And he said, why don't you go back to England? You don't belong here. And I was like, I've got no money. I don't know where my passport is. I'd been in Nigeria about 7.5 years by this time. And I didn't know where to get money from to do that. So he said, I'll tell you what. He said, when my wife gets back, we'll get your passport and you'll have a British passport. And I'm like, okay. So the passport arrives and I'm thinking, okay, got a British passport. And he said, I'm going to hold on to it because I don't want you to lose it. And I said, okay. So he held on to it. A couple of weeks later, I went around to his house and we were sitting there talking. And he throws this brown envelope across the table. And he says to me, by the way, that's yours. And I open up this envelope, and inside this envelope is my passport and a first class ticket back to London. But that was the beginning of a friendship.
Wow.
It was one of those moments, and it's still a moment that still moves me today. It's had a very profound impact on me. And I think what that did to me, everything I've done from that point until now has been trying to give back to the world or people the feeling that was given to me in that moment. The interesting thing is, coming back to that belonging, is I came back and I thought, yes, I'm back now in London. Go on.
I just want to pause on that, though, because I do find that very profound, and you described it as a feeling. Could you elaborate on what that feeling was for you? Because I thought freedom, but I think it's more complicated.
There was just so much wrapped up in that. It was like somebody giving you back your life. It's almost like you've wanted something for so long and you've given up any hope of it ever happening. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, out of the blue, it happens in the most unexpected of ways. By that time, the path had no longer existed. I was just drifting. I didn't know. I didn't have a plan. I didn't have any. I was just drifting. I was just going where the wind blew because I didn't know what to do or where to go. So this came along and it just, in some ways, it anchored me. It gave me back, like I said, it gave me back my life. And it was like, I'm coming back home. I'm coming back and life is going to be brilliant now because I'm not going to be in that place anymore. I'm not going to be drifting no more. Everything's going to be fantastic. Everything's going to be great. If only life was that simple.
Mm. Well, yeah. Rarely is.
But again, I came back to the UK 8 years after I'd left. And it was incredible how much London had changed in those 8 years. And the mental image I had of when I left and when I came back was totally different. McDonald's, when I left, had just started in the UK. Mm-hmm. And suddenly there was McDonald's everywhere. When I left, cash machines didn't exist and all these sort of things. So there were things that suddenly there's all this technology, all this stuff. And I came back to a world I didn't know. The school I went to had been demolished. So everything that I thought I knew about the world had gone. So I was again in this place of, how do I fit in? Where do I belong? And that took some adjusting to. The other side of it was that I came back filled with anger. I had a lot of anger and a lot of hatred. And one of the biggest things I hated was I hated being black. I hated myself. And I was sort of thinking, I didn't know what to do. So I was working as a security guard in a shopping center, and the local police would come in to pick up the shoplifters, and occasionally we'd sort of socialize. And then they kept saying to me, you know, you should join the police. And I'm like, no, it's not for me. I don't like the police. I hate the police. But then, you know, after working with them for about a year or so, probably 2 years, you stop seeing the uniform and you start seeing the people.
Mm.
So it goes from being police officers to seeing Bob and Jeff and Nancy and Mary and whatever. And then you start drinking with them, you start socializing with them. And I thought, okay, I'll give it a go. And I joined the police, not because I wanted to be a police officer. I joined the police because I didn't want to be black. And I felt that that badge was a way of saying to the world, I'm not one of them, I'm one of you. Look at me, I've got credibility. And again, going back to, what do we do or what do we give up to belong? And my rucksack of belonging or not belonging, as the case may be, was getting heavier and heavier because I had nowhere to put the rocks. I had nowhere to put the pain. And it was just getting heavier. And I was sacrificing. Every time I sacrificed a bit of myself, that rucksack got heavier. In effect, I became my own bully.
And I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because I think that's something that all too often is still missed around the conversation of racism, how racialized trauma isn't only about the things that other people do to you. It can be around how societal influences you can internalize and you can weaponize against yourself. All the times you might not speak up or you might change your behavior because there's an assumption that there'll be a backlash, that you can then, you know, stamp out parts of yourself with the anticipation of racism.
And I would say not just with racism.
Yeah.
You know, it can be with gender, it can be with disability, it can be with... I've seen that behaviour in so many different groups and so many different individuals.
Yeah, you know, well, we talk about it with mental health stigma. You know, how many times you don't mention it, you don't tell people what's going on for you, what the reality of your day is, because the threat of how they might react.
That's the really sad part around a lot of this stuff, is the lack of space or the lack of space or courage to have a courageous conversation.
And in doing so, for anyone to get the opportunity to know you, to like who you are. You know, that's what's heartbreaking for me, I think, actually, most of all. You know, when I look back on, like, all the work I've done in terms of anti-stigma and anti-discrimination of all kinds, how many people are living a life they think they should, being a person that they think they should be, and not being themselves and not living authentically.
Yes.
And then we wonder why it's hard for people to relate to us.
Yeah.
You wonder then why you feel lonely.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's why I say this isn't a characteristic thing. It's a human thing.
Yeah.
Whether we use race, sexual orientation, gender, disability, whatever we use, it's about connection or the disconnect with humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And it is about, you said it there, it's also about the map we've been given or the world we've been given. And I ask this question, it's like, are you living the life you want or the life you've been given?
Yeah. And then from what I understand of your experience in serving in the Metropolitan Police is in many ways, it might have felt like that was working. that holding back who you really were and, you know, trying to fit in, even when it was to your own detriment of character, well, you know, you were a successful officer in so many ways.
Yeah, so you made me think there. You have a way of saying things that makes me think.
Good, I hope so.
It's survival. Again, that's the word that keeps coming back to my mind. It's what do we do to survive? What do we do to survive when we haven't been given the tools and the skills to live?
Yeah.
Because until you understand how to live, all you are doing is surviving.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So my survival phrase, I would go along with jokes. I would allow myself to be the butt of jokes. And when I look back, some of the things I did, I look back now and I think, I really hated myself. I was filling up that rucksack. Nobody was doing it to me. I was doing it to myself. And I think, Bobby, that's the thing, that if we want to understand what's going on, we have to understand where we sit within that dynamic as well.
Yeah.
It's not only about what happens to me, it's about how I'm interpreting it.
How much that rucksack is becoming who you are.
Yeah. Yeah. And no one ever teaches you that you can put it down.
Yeah.
Because you've never told anyone you're carrying it.
Mm-hmm. Or that's it, or someone else can help you carry it.
Yeah. And the thing is, there were people along the way who would have gladly helped me carry it. But I didn't hear them or see them because I wasn't in a space where I could trust. Or life had taught me that you can't trust anyone because I never belonged. And it's back to that, you know, that sense of loneliness again. So I would create a character to fit in. And I think it got to a point where that character was destroying me. And I didn't know how to stop him.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like my Jekyll and Hyde.
And you mentioned there the things that you would go along with. Do you mind sharing any examples?
The most famous one was when I was at the training school and some guys came into my room and said, you're the wrong colour to be in this job. And they held me down. And I say held me down. I voluntarily let them hold me down. I didn't fight back. And they painted me white with shoe whitener. And I allowed them to do it because I saw that as, this is what I have to sacrifice to belong. In fact, it was that thought wasn't even in my head. It was just that this is my whole life is do what you need to do to fit in.
Yeah.
So it was an unconscious, consensual behavior.
Well, did you also think that was true, that you were the wrong color for that job? Did you internalize that part?
I probably did, but unconsciously, without even being aware of it, right? But it was also like, I mean, what was probably the dominant thought was, I want to fit in, I want to belong. And I was blind to anything else.
Yeah, you were trying to laugh along.
Yeah, I don't want you to see me as a problem. I don't want you to see me as those people you hate on the street. Yeah. I want you to see me as one of you, so I will sacrifice my dignity, my self-worth, my credibility to make you like me, which is going back to that kid giving away his sweets and his pocket money in the playground. Only now, the currency I was giving away was a lot more profound. It wasn't about sweets and pocket money now. Now it was about me. I was giving away me.
They're giving up you in a way.
Mm.
I just wanted to pause on what you said there about the us and them mentality, right? That can be such a big part of policing in general, you know, this idea of the thin blue line, the officers, and then the unruly public, and, you know, how what the world would be like if you weren't there. You know, I think that is still a big part of the mentality that's drummed into policing. And with what you referenced around an us and them mentality towards skin colour, was that openly discussed around you? Had you fitted into the extent where people would make racist comments around other people and you being in the room would not even...
I would even make racist comments. I would even make... But, you know, the racism wasn't just in the police. It was on the streets as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I had people, I'd turn up to incidents and people said, you're not a proper copper because of my colour, you know, and they'd probably fight with me because they didn't think that I deserved to be a police officer or I deserved to have that power over them. So it wasn't just in the police station. It was people, you know, I look at it and I say, I look at it this way. I enjoyed the profession of policing. Because, you know, on the positive side, there were some incredibly profound and powerful moments that I had. When I still talk to new recruits coming into policing today, and I said, one of the beauties of policing is you get to see people behind their masks. You get to see humanity in its rawest form.
Hmm.
You turn up at, I remember turning up at a burglary. This woman had been burgled overnight. And she opened the door for me to come in. And for the first 10 minutes of me being in the house, she didn't even realize she was naked. She was in such shock at being burgled that she'd forgotten to put her clothes on.
Wow.
And, you know, you had to gradually break it gently to her, saying, you know, it might be a good idea for you to put something on. And you know that the moment you say that, that shock is going to get, oh, my God, I've been walking around naked. And you've got to learn to handle that and make them feel safe, make them feel reassured. You know, you go to, for example, if a woman's been raped, and I say a woman, whether it's a man, but you go to a woman who's been raped, and sometimes the last thing they want to see is a man. And you have to sort of like gain their trust. And those are the moments where I valued policing. Somebody comes up to you and says, oh, my God, I've lost my little Tommy. You know, they've gone running around. I don't know where they are in the shopping center. What they want you to say is, don't worry, we'll find him and everything will be okay. And you can't say that. So how do you then reassure someone without giving them what they want?
Yeah, because at its best, you get to help people. You know, people can reach out when they're most vulnerable. And you get to connect with them on that deep human level.
Oh, and, hugely.
You know, potentially, you know, transform a situation for them. You know, something like a burglary, unless you've been through it, it's difficult to really understand how profoundly that can change your entire feeling of safety, that your home has been invaded in that way. And a lot of people, you know, how that 24 hours afterwards goes defines whether or not they stay in that house, whether they stay in that town.
Exactly.
You know, it's that deep for people. And, you know, it is incredible when you get to have that impact. But then also on the flip side, it's really something to even try and wrap your head around at all when you describe someone calling in their hour of need and they're desperate for help and the help arrives. And then your skin colour is the thing that they're more focused on. You know, how embedded these mentalities can be, that becomes their new priority.
And I can give you a very good example of that. Very early in my career, a young woman had been robbed on her way from the station home. And they got home and called the police. And I turned up at the door. And the mum opened the door, looked at me up and down, and said, "We don't allow niggers in this house." I just looked at her and said, "I'm here as a police officer. And if you ask me to go away, no other police officer is going to come and report this crime." Right? And her daughter was behind her and shouted, "Mum, let him in." And I remember it was the living room was an open plan living room. And I sat on this sofa and behind me, the mum was sitting at the dining table. And I'm talking to the daughter and I could feel the mum's eyes burning into the back of my head. Like, I could feel her glare. And I just did my job and did everything. And I got to the end and I said to her, right, I said to the daughter, "Is there anything you need to ask? Is everything okay?" And she goes, "No." I said, "Right, this is what you need to do. This, da, da, da." And I really did everything well. And then the mum, as I got up, the mum turned around and said, "Officer, would you like a cup of tea?"
Wow.
I could have turned around and said, "No, to hell with you, you racist."
Right.
And I said, "Yes. And if you've got some biscuits, I'll have them as well." And I sat down and I had a cup of tea with the woman. And I sat down and I talked to her for about 10 minutes while I drank my tea. And I left there thinking, I've changed someone. And those are the moments that were a privilege that made that role, you know, made it a privilege to do that role.
Yeah, because you're accessing these moments when, you know, someone would only otherwise have like a friend, a really close friend or a family member, you know, even know about some of the things they might have been through. Yeah. And you're a stranger that steps in and gains someone's trust. Yeah. And when that's done well, you know, policing can be incredible. Yeah.
And the thing is, it is done well every single day. Right? There are so many interactions like that taking place right now that you never hear about because they never make the news, because they're not newsworthy. And the sad thing is, in the police service, there's police officers that just take them for granted. And, you know, you may have been burgled tonight. That might be the first time in your life you've ever been burgled. But for me, as the officer, that's the 10th burglary I've dealt with that morning. Mm. So I'm just coming in to do my... And I always tell them, don't forget the human factor. And I think that that's what happens, that the humanity gets lost because it becomes routine. And also, you know, you look at it, I think there was a study that said the average person in their life probably has about 5 or 6 traumatic incidents, majorly traumatic incidents in their life, right? Police officers are dealing with 10, 20... traumatic incidents a week, and they have to carry that around and still raise their families and still socialize with their friends. And I'm not saying this to defend them. I'm saying this that it's not as easy as saying that they belong in that camp or they belong in that camp. There is just so much, it's such a mixture of stuff going on in that space. Such a mix of stuff. And if you don't know how to handle it or navigate it or work with it or understand it, it can be explosive. It can be explosive. You know, I know people that it drove to drink.
I can believe it. Absolutely. I've seen it happen. And, you know, I told you on the emails that I was in West Midlands Police for a period of time. And I was involved in like initial investigations work. I wasn't out on the beat like you were. But, you know, I did deal with 999 calls. I did a range of things. Yeah. And so, you know, I've seen that trauma very much brought to my door. And there were certain things that you know, were very clear of why I couldn't remain in that role for me and for my morals, you know. And it was kind of two camps. It was stuff to do with the institution that, you know, whilst West Midlands Police is policing an incredibly diverse place, and as an Irish person that was living there, you know, I was proud to be part of that diversity. The force was not reflective of that.
Yeah.
And even when it was, there were so many promises being made around, you know, reforms, around changing the way we do things, around supporting the community better, that were not being followed through. And so there was so much of that that morally I couldn't square. But then there was also the other category, which was things that morally I couldn't square because of a lot of it coming back to resources. That there were, you know, even in my brief time there, burglaries was one of the examples of a type of case which our superiors were trying to get us to stop sending officers to. And so there was pressure on me to downgrade cases, to find excuses not to send officers, not because they didn't care about or appreciate the severity of those cases, but because we didn't have the officers to send.
You know. And that's a classic example of what I'm saying, is that the human element goes out the window because it becomes about a process.
You can imagine, maybe from knowing me even briefly, what I was doing, which was I was finding excuses to send officers. I was doing the exact opposite. You know, I didn't know how else to sleep at night.
Mm.
You know, and there are still cases like that I'll never forget. You know, like when we were delayed several hours going to a domestic violence incident because the officers kept being pulled. Like, I would see them be routed and then they'd get pulled onto something else that was considered, you know, more imminent. And then in this particular case, the man came back and beat her up a second time because we didn't get the officers to her when we should have done, because we didn't have enough officers to deal with all the crimes in the area. Yeah. You know, how do you, you know, I don't think I'll ever forget that.
Yeah. And if you think about, you know, how many incidents are there like that that police officers are carrying around within them as well? Right? So if you look at, if you get back to what I was saying about me, so I've got that going on. Then on top of that, I'm still dealing with issues around my colour. I'm still, dealing with issues around my sexual orientation. I'm not in connection with my family. So, I look at it and sort of like, I was going to break.
Yeah.
At some point, I was going to break. And I did break. And the catalyst was I was indecently assaulted by a senior officer, a gay senior officer, a gay male. And I wasn't out at this time, so he couldn't use the excuse that he was gay or stuff like that. But I was in the photocopying room. I was picking up some paper. And he came in and he said, oh, I like myself a black ass. And he grabbed me and started to dry hump me. And I sort of stood up, really got angry. And he walked out the room laughing. And I reported it. And I was taken to the, we call it professional standards. And the senior officer who was supposed to be, who was allocated to investigate it, his opening line in this interview was, at the end of the day, G, he's a senior officer, you're a PC, do you really think this is going to go anywhere? And I remember thinking, that's your starting point? And I just went out, I walked out his office, it was a Friday, went home, and I spent the whole weekend just walking around in circles in the living room. Got to Monday morning, and I wrote a suicide note, put it on the coffee table. Something stopped me. I don't know what. I don't know why. I'm just grateful now that it did. I just went blank. But that was the point where the weight of my rucksack was just too heavy to carry. And I broke, basically. And I ended up having a breakdown, which I look back on and think that was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, because it made me, I suddenly realized I had no idea who I was. I suddenly realized that everything that I thought I was what I've been told I am. And the only person who hadn't told me who I was me. And that was a big shocker. So ever since that point till now, it's been a journey of discovery, of finding myself. And I like being in spaces of not knowing how things are going to go, because I think I'm going to learn something about myself in this space. Mm-hmm. Now, people will say to me, oh, we've got these interviews. I said, I don't want to know what the questions are. I want to surprise myself as much as you want to be surprised.
I love that. And I also feel like that is, in a way, such a sign of how far you've come. Mm. That you now can see the opportunity in being in situations that would have been unsettling, where you would have been caught off guard. Now you see the opportunity because you have the safe base of knowing who you are, knowing your strengths, knowing that despite it all, you can belong. Yeah. And not just that, you can inspire others to change.
I would even add to that, is that it's not about knowing who I am. It's about knowing that I don't know who I am and being comfortable with that.
Fair play, because that is a scary space to be.
That is a place I love. I know who I am today, but something could happen in the next 5 minutes, an hour, that would totally flip that on its head. Mm-hmm. And I love looking for those moments.
Well, as we start to round up then, when you look back on your service, because you did 25 years, you worked in a lot of areas supporting training, supporting reforms around discrimination and reforms more generally. To what extent are you able to reconcile all the complexities that we've touched on, all the times when you went along with things that you can understand the rationale now, but was still, a trauma to figure out at the time and in the years after? How much have you found peace with that?
I found peace with it all. And the reason why I say that is that I know that there's issues. I'm never going to be 100% at peace. But the difference is, I look at the life I have now, and I think if I didn't go through those experiences, would I be the man I am today? I look at my, I call them chisels. There were things that were carving me into the person I've become today. So I don't look back with regret. I don't look back with sadness. I don't look back with bitterness. I look back with gratitude and look forward with hope.
I love that. What a wonderful place to wrap up. Thank you so much for sharing with me and all that you've done, sharing your story so many times and being, you know, willing to be so honest with it. You know, I know firsthand how exhausting that can be, and to, you know, still be raw with me and have moments of, you know, the real emotion, you know, in this space, I really appreciate.
Thank you. Like I said, you hold space well.
Thank you. I'm so glad. And if people want to find out more about you, I am going to plug for you an incredible short film that you did with The Guardian, right? And it's called The Black Cop, and it recently won a BAFTA, which I see proudly displayed just behind you there. And yes, it's incredible that you've managed to distill so many powerful messages, and, you know, right from like the opening lines, which I could read. I have them written down, but I'm gonna let the listeners go find for themselves. You'll hear so many additional layers to the conversation today if you go check that out. In addition to that, do you want to share a bit about your company and other work you're involved in?
Yeah, well, I have a company now called Purple Frog Connections, which is purplefrog-connections.com. I deliver diversity programs and training. I also help people to have, or organizations to have, courageous conversations around difference, around discrimination. I do public speaking, I do keynote talks or presentations. And I think what I actually do is I give people permission to engage with their own story. One of my opening lines in my workshops is, I know what I'm going to say, but only you know what you're going to hear.
I like that. You're almost too profound to handle. I feel like I'm going to have to wait till I listen back to this. And I will have missed every other great thing you've said because there's so many. Well, with that all said then, we will wrap up there. Thank you again so much. In a moment, we'll be back for the Apple Podcast subscribers. And I want to ask you a bit about the role of policing as it relates to mental health, because, you know, so often there is a crossover, and I know that's a very complicated issue to, yeah, but I'm keen to hear your perspective. So for now, thank you. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.